So it's a dropping into and resting in it. And sometimes it's a bit more on the surface and sometimes it's deeper. But also this authentic presence is not only about us as the care provider or caregiver. It's also about the other person. So we create it together as a dynamic field, because sometimes the other person inspires me because what he, she truthfully tells me a really heartbreaking story or something that resonates with me. And, oh yeah, I really hear you. So it opens my heart. So I allowing the other person to open my heart.
We are witnessing so many remarkable miracles in this modern age of medical sciences. But what about a wisdom that is capable of containing this intellectual genius? Please join me as I engage in conversations with remarkable healers from different traditions, as we explore wisdom that can both inspire and inform our work as 21st century healers. So welcome. Please join us on the Healers Council. Welcome, everybody, and welcome to the Healers Council. And just as with our other remarkable guests, I know we're going to have a very fruitful and meaningful conversation today with our very special guest who's joining us all the way over on the wild coast of Ireland, County Cork. And I hope to visit there soon. So our guest today is Kirsten DeLeo. And Kirsten and I actually go back more than 20 years. We actually haven't seen each other for 10 years. So one of the things I love about the podcast is that it gives me an opportunity to connect with old friends and make new friends. And so as you're going to learn, I know, in the next hour or so in our conversation, Kirsten is a really remarkable person who's doing really important work. Kirsten is currently residing, as I mentioned, in County Cork in Ireland, and she is working with the Dzogchen Bera Retreat Center in County Cork. And if any of you haven't heard about this retreat center, I'd really recommend it to you. Dzogchen Bera, Dzogchen. It'll be on the website how you can access that. Kirsten has had many years working in the field of what has been called spiritual caregiving. And I think we'll have a little conversation about what that might mean and is that chaplaincy. And she heads up educational programming at Dzogchen Bera. She has been trained in Hakomi mindfulness-based practices and this approach to psychotherapy. And for many years has been deeply immersed in Tibetan Buddhist practice. And this has even included, I'm going to ask her about this, a three-year meditation retreat. Actually, I do believe the last time she and I actually worked together was she was just about to head off to the three-year meditation retreat in Ireland. And I was, I think I'll stay in Texas. I know it's going to be interesting to talk about that retreat and how it, her experiences about how that might help or influence our ability to be a healer. And Kirsten has most recently written a very wonderful book. Those on the video will be able to see this one day. It's called Present Through the End, A Caring Companion's Guide for Accompanying the Dying. And it's available through Shambhala. It's on Amazon, and I really recommend it. It should be a handbook, not just for healthcare professionals, but for all of us, because life is impermanent, and all of us all will be needing caregiving, and most of us will actually be caregivers. So this is a wonderful handbook that I urge you to pick up. Welcome, Kirsten.
Thank you, Jim, for this lovely introduction. And it's lovely to reconnect.
Yeah,
I cannot believe it's been so long. Huh?
Yeah, sorry that we can't go out for a beer at the local pub.
Oh, that would be lovely. I okay. have a hot whiskey this time.
Yeah, hot whiskey, yeah. That sounds Irish to me. One of the traditions that we have on the Healers Council, and it's very interesting and informative, I think, to all of us, is asking each of our healers to share with us something about their personal story as to, gee, how'd you end up being consider the healer on the Healer's Council and identifying yourself as a healer, what was that all about? How did that happen? What's your understanding? Because as I always say, I always quote Joseph Campbell, life is like showing up in a movie and no one's giving you the script, right? And we just said, okay, I'm you know, whatever, 60 years old and I'm considered a healer, and what just happened? So could you share with us some of your experiences around that and perspectives and how you got here?
That really resonated with me, Joseph Campbell's quote. I think that seems to be, not having a script is the best thing, you know, to be open and see what comes. Yeah, when you invited me, Jim, you said healers, healer being a healer. And I realized I don't self-identify as a healer. That's a big label and a big responsibility, at least from my understanding. And I said, oh, but maybe it's the process of facilitating healing. So it's, if we talk about the spiritual aspect of that journey. And then I said, yeah, we all on that journey together, then yeah. And the more I am, you know, whole in terms of healthy, and then on the spiritual plane and emotional plane, the more I'm in touch with myself, the more I'm actually make space for others, can welcome others and be present. Yeah. And that in my mind, thinking about this podcast, I thought, oh yeah, then that might be something, entryway to our conversation. And you asked how I started or what. Yeah.
Oh, come on. Why become a healer? Why not become a software engineer or a...
You know, my intention was always to help people. So whatever form, that was my main motivation. It doesn't matter what form it takes, and then 20s, I got interested in end-of-life care and hospice care, palliative care. And I grew up in Germany, and at the time there was nothing there or hardly anything there. So I remember I went into, I was born and raised in Frankfurt am Main, and there was is still to this day this big teaching hospital. So I went there and they had an AIDS ward, so I tried to volunteer there, and there was no accompaniment, you know. There was this medical, so it was a pure medical model, but this, even the emotional support wasn't there. And that was very shocking to see people die without that human, that human, very basic human response and kindness.
Why would a young woman, 20 years old, why? Could end up walking around the hospitals experiencing suffering?
You know, it might sound old-fashioned, but I knew, since I remember, I was interested by death, you know, always when I grew, even as a teenager, it's like there was something, you would maybe now call it a calling, I don't know, but yeah, sounds very old-fashioned, but for me, that's what it was. And
how old were you when you became aware that you had a calling to...
I think, honestly, as a teenager, 14, 15. As a teenager. And of course, my family was suffering, there was dying, there was death, there was illness.
We all bring our own stories with us.
So another made me inquisitive, you know. But that took me quite a lot of time to actually go that path, because you're conditioned, you go to school, you go to university, you get your degree. I studied German literature, history, and so completely different field. And
but within your own family, you had witnessed people suffer.
Absolutely. My mom was very ill. And I think that really does something when you have your main care, you know, the care for the, well, you know, I really loved my mother. So if your dearest person is suffering, and she was unwell for many years. And so as a young person, I just had to come to terms with it. And I thought there was also normal, you know, there was a normality to it, you know, that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. And I had to get used to it. So from early on, I was a caregiver, but I also was lucky that I still had the chance to play and be a child and be a teenager, I think. Mm-hmm. So it was not traumatic in that way. I really feel like I was blessed with that. So I had that support, which I know many others didn't have.
So it wasn't that you were hopelessly depressed and feeling responsible and shameful. Mm-hmm. It was you were able to find joy in life, but part of there's a need here that I need to.
Yeah, that's still, of course, as a German, you still feel responsible. That comes with a cultural upbringing, you know, and so but the beautiful thing, so I got interested in this work in this field. I was then trained as a journalist, and because I was really interested in people and what makes people tick in the human aspect of life. And then I heard about hospice, and then I got interested. I started as a volunteer, and so it just one step after another. Mm-hmm. And then I came I heard about Buddhism. I got interested. I started to practice. At the time, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying was really such a classic, a really bestseller. So I really studied that. And then I heard that you could actually learn more about the contemplative or Buddhist way of accompaniment at the Zen Center, Zen Hospice in San Francisco. So I just packed up my bags in my 20s and went. And so that's how I started, just following this one step. It was completely unplanned. And now in hindsight, looking back, I could see, oh, yes, that was makes complete sense, you know, when you look back. But at the time was, no, this feels just right. I think just to listen to your inner voice that's telling you that this inner knowing mind, to really trust that.
I'm hearing curiosity, really,
and
courage. It must have taken tremendous courage for a young woman to come over from Germany to San Francisco. You were really courageous. And we were going to come back to courage, as we talked about, and with this concept of presence, which I really want us to take a deep dive on today, because you're an expert in that. So where is this thing, the Buddhism, and how did you... You could have gone a lot of different ways, but you ended up, and this is where we met, in working with Christine Longacre. And Christine wrote a landmark book, Facing Death and Finding Hope. I do recommend it to people, Facing Death and Finding Hope, Christine Longacre. And so you start working with Christine, working with end-of-life care specifically, and what you call spiritual caregiving, but within the context of the Dharma, within the context of Buddhism. Tell us about that, but I'm really interested the difference, you know, what is spiritual care? Is this just hospital chaplaincy, or is there something specific about spiritual caregiving that maybe working from the Dharma was something that you were interested in?
I'm always have been interested in the being with part. You may call that spiritual or spiritual care, or spiritual accompaniment. And so with Christine, who was a really good friend, such a longtime friend and mentor when I started as a young woman, the idea was, so she helped to create the spiritual care program, which was an outreach program of Rigpa, Buddhist organization. The idea was, it's not about for people to become Buddhist practitioners, you know, it's really using the tools, the wisdom and the understanding, the basic principles to help people to be there, to help people to be well, to help people prepare, to offer a different point of view, a different perspective that's actually empowering, and empowering in the sense of that people can die well, that people are prepared, that to alleviate the fear that still to this day surrounds death. A lot has happened, but I think we still, every generation, there's a different aspect coming. So for spiritual caregiving, I find this whole notion of caregiving quite problematic, honestly, you know. Because as this implies, there is a receiver and as a giver, and there is an inequality just already built in, you know, I offer something to you because you're lacking something. And from the Buddhist point of view, or from a spiritual point of view, no, we are all whole. That's the basic premise. You know, that made me also, when I first learned this, that this is, we are all whole. We are all healthy fundamentally. So that's the starting ground. And that's our foundation. That really made so much sense. And so the question is, how do we remember and how do we return to it? How do we rediscover? So I don't have to offer the other person anything new. It's more giving them a space where they can rediscover that for themselves and whatever they may name it or call it. Some call it spiritual, some call it religious, some call it not anything. But there is a deeper way of being, and they know that, the deeper truth. And we don't often have no language for it. Maybe the in-between places of quietness or stillness or silence often. So spiritual caregiving, it's not about the giving. It's very creating or facilitating a healing space. Where, yeah, so I think that's more, I think the definition, I think that's my own practice and experience seems more what's actually is happening. A field of healing where I bring a spiritual awareness to the conversation or to the meeting.
Well, you've used the word space several times. And let's go right in already. Let's get into presence because this is a big one. I love this quotation from Jiddu Krishnamurti. He said, in the space between subject and object lies the entire history of human suffering. I love that quotation. So this whole concept of space and spaciousness, it's very much a Buddhist thing, right? Not something you learn in any of our healthcare professional schools. I remember a number of years ago when I was heading up an institute in Houston for spirituality and health, Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, I asked Tenzin Wangyal if he could give us a talk on healing. And he said, sure, I'll talk about space as healing. And I thought, oh my goodness, I have no idea. This is not going to be good, right? But he gave a talk on space and healing, and it was actually the most powerful talk I'd ever heard on healing. So let's talk about space and healing and specifically this whole concept of presence, because this is really, you have your authentic presence program now that people can do online and you have in-person retreats. What is that? You know, we use that word a lot. When I was a neuropsychiatrist, hardcore neuropsychiatrist, one day my friend said to me, hey Jim, can you do me a favor and just sit in on the hospice team meeting next week? I'm going to be on vacation and they need a doc to be there to sign the orders. It's just a pro forma thing. No one's going to ask you any questions. You just sit with the staff. That's fine. And I went up and I sat with this group of wonderful people. And the first hospice nurse, visiting hospice nurse, she said, Mr. Jones was in the active phase of dying and he was comfortable and the family was comfortable. I was present. And everybody nodded their heads. And then they went on to the next case. I was like, excuse me, what did you just say? You were present.
What do you mean?
And they all looked at me with a kind of a knowing smile, and like you might look at a small child who's asking a very obvious question. And they moved on. And actually, that's what brought me for many years to work with palliative medicine was, what on earth is presence anyway? Because this whole field of hospice seems to... This is its lifeblood, is presence. So let's have a conversation about presence. And so where do you want to start with that conversation about presence? Not presence,
about presence. Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways. I loved your story because this is what it is. I think everybody, you know, most people in end of life care, when you say presence, they're not their heads. Exactly. But it's still so unique, and just to really unpack it is actually really helpful and not assume you're talking about the same thing, you know. It's not to sit there and be silent and pass the time, or I don't know what to say, so I don't say anything. That's a stepping stone. But when authentic presence, the program I'm part of, we offer contemplative end of life care, and it's been around for 20 years now. And the initial name was contemplative end of life care, and nobody could remember the name, and we had it for years. Our students, our graduates could not remember the name, and the faculty finally caught on that something is not working, you know. Yeah, so it's a technical name. And then we asked our graduates over the years, so what did you actually learn, what did you take away? And so many said presence, authenticity, authentic presence. And this is when we changed the name. It's like, ah, a light bulb went on, you know, this is what we've been doing. But we, you know, sometimes you do something for a long time, it works, but then somebody else has to point it out. This is what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful and enlightening. So authentic presence, as you, it's, the presence is about, is of course about being present, being there. It's not about being spaced out, but this quality of inner spaciousness, that everything is welcome, this really welcoming attitude, and also the view that you're a whole person, I'm a whole person. And also this is a human interaction. I think this is what I see, where so much unnecessary, almost also suffering for the caregiver for comes in, that's actually not recognized. The human aspect of that accompaniment is not recognized. The profundity and what it actually means to be present with suffering, to sit at the threshold of life and death, and how much it can take out of you, literally. The fear, the anxiety, the burden. And so it does, that's where courage comes in. You know, the courage, just to the bravery, just to stay when we don't know what to say, to stay when we don't have the answers. And it comes out of a very deep well of compassion, because I cannot see, I cannot look the other way. Yeah, I see you suffer. At least what I can do is be present. And then in the most profound way, and that's where authenticity comes in, that's learning to lean into our own mortality. And I think that's something is so important for all carers or caregivers, to learn to lean into our own mortality. And I use the word leaning in, it's getting used to, it's becoming familiar, and it's an ongoing process, it never ends. So just to lean into that and to allow this to touch us, our own mortality, our own impermanence. And this takes courage, but the more we're able to do that, it really then creates this healing space. That I actually know myself a bit better, and I can be there with you. And then authentic presence together is really, on the spiritual plane, is the highest way of coming from our true nature. You know, in Buddhism, you would call it Buddha nature, Buddha mind, the big mind, the vast, spacious, sky-like essence of who we all actually are. If you, the more we are connected with that, that's free from all the anxieties, is not undefined by any feelings or emotions, that just move through it. And yeah, so it's that's, so you can see authentic presence has so many layers and levels, the individual practitioners to connect with.
So my question, that young woman in Frankfurt, what she observed, which was very remarkable, was that people didn't want to go into the rooms of patients who were dying.
Yeah.
And of course, this continued. I think actually now what we've done is we've actually created a medical specialty that goes into the room. I have a cartoon. There's a doctor talking to a patient and he says, I have really bad news to give you. It's such bad news, I have to call in the specialist to tell you. You know, good news is that we've created the specialists, that these folks, and I often used to say, all I am is somebody who is willing to show up. I actually don't have any answers, but I am willing to show. I guess the question, so is it just that healthcare providers don't have any courage?
Absolutely not. I think that I gave the right answer, right? But no, it's not about that. It's not about not having the courage. It's not being, when I started not having models, I think that's the thing, not having models, not having encouragement, not being empowered, that what we meet there, especially at the end of life, it will touch you. Mm-hmm. You know, you will feel your own mortality. You will feel vulnerable. You will feel at times heartbroken, and that's normal. It's a normal, and you will also grieve, but also there is an incredible intimacy, beauty to see that as well. So that's life, to recognize this is life. This is the life you all live.
Yeah, but what I hear you saying is that ultimately to be present, one has to be able to inhabit one's own experience.
Absolutely.
And, so I find it helpful. If we go back, I'm sure this applies to German words, but English words, actually, we use all these words every day, but we never actually spend some time with them. For example, presence. If you actually sit with the word presence, pre-senses, right? But before we're even aware that we're seeing a particular thing or conceptualizing, I think it's pre-sense, right? Be good if we could actually change the C to an S, pre-sense, right?
And
So very much a first person. Then, of course, absence. Most of us are absent, and there's profound consequences. Sherry Geller, I don't know if you know Sherry Geller's work on this, but very interesting in terms of, you know, what are the consequences of being absent, away from our senses, right? In other words, living in our intellect. And you, I think that you could probably argue that the primary reason that we're experiencing so much burnout is because we are absent from the very source of vitality that is generated within our relationships with each other, right? And Sadhguru is so wonderful. He said, somebody asked him, what's definition? He says, it's simply the loss of our vitality. So when we're absent from that source, in that space between us, we disconnect from the life force, from that wellspring of enlivenment, right?
So
we've agreed that clinicians they're not cowards.
Absolutely not.
But there's something
they're quite courageous. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I have in our trainings or here in our retreat center, we get so many young people, and they're all seekers. They know something in the system is not working. I get all the skills and competencies, but there's something deeper that has not been addressed. So there's literally seeking, and it falls onto the individual practitioner to figure that out. And it's often a quite painful process. Either they go on for years and you burn out and you leave the profession, or you find the magic in it. Yeah, so I see these both types, you know. Those who find the magic through trial and error, they found something within themselves that really enables them to be there and to hold the suffering, the depth of suffering of a dying person, of the grieving process, family members, and especially when we cannot do anything. But what you're saying is really the value of presence, you know, that it's the greatest value. It's interesting, reflecting on our upcoming conversation, presence in Tibetan Buddhism is very fascinating. And maybe some of your other guests went into it. Presence in Tibetan Buddhism would be translated as wontong, which field of power.
Mm.
So the more, we know that by somebody's presence, we can feel the person's presence, and we can feel while they're fully within themselves, they're embodied, right? Mm-hmm. This level of embodiment comes in, and we can feel the person. They have a commanding presence. That's how we talk about them. So you have this field of power, but it's benevolent, you know, it's good kind. And it's based on merit, it's based on the positivity of all the positive things you accumulated in this lifetimes and, of course, past lifetimes, you know, that's if you believe in that. But that's the idea of it. So we can actually actively cultivate presence and direct it and to benefit. And I also was reflecting, contemplating with presence. It's a noun. Now in English is a noun. And I struggle with a noun, honestly. It's not a thing. You know, Germans love nouns. They're long things. And you cannot even translate the word presence really accurately into the German language. They're different. So it's a noun. But then I thought, is it more a verb, like presencing? Is it more a verb? But then it means, we might think, I'm doing something. I'm doing something. But for me, in my own personal practice, I feel like it's actually very a being. So I move from doing to being. It's a being, the being aspect of being present, being. Yeah.
And so then, moving from being a human doing to a human being.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So you just said there that what I didn't know about that Tibetan word, it's never come up. That gave me goosebumps. So that within that tradition, the concept of presence really is how we are manifesting our being, but not just our being, but how much we are connected, how much space we have. The wider the connections, the more stable they are, the more organized they are, then the great. I know you've experienced this, having been to a number of teachings with lamas, but particularly the Dalai Lama. One actually knows that he's arrived probably about 15 minutes before he walks in the room. There's suddenly you could be waiting for an hour with the secret servants.
Exactly.
And then suddenly everybody just stops. And it's like, oh. And then the word goes out, Elvis is in the building. And it's and then I think it was Thomas Merton who said he can always tell a holy person before they've even entered the room, right? So I love that word. I have to spend some time with that word. But you also said that this is a specific attribute that can be cultivated. So that word cultivation, self-cultivation.
Yeah.
So your program really has a roadmap for how we can self-cultivate this?
Yes, and that sounds quite ambitious, but it can become we can train in it, because we all have the capacity to be authentically present. It's not something that's given or it's not. You know, I remember when I first started this, because I could see some people seem to be at the bedside just naturally kind and compassionate, and others had to really work hard on it. And I said, oh, maybe it's something you are compassionate or you're not. And then I was so grateful to discover there's a whole training path. I can cultivate my mind and heart, which go together, not separate, and be embodied. And I can train it through method, through contemplative practice. And yeah, that's the way of cultivation.
But you just said something very important.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You said it's not a talent. It's not something, you know, often we say, oh, well, she's just really good at being empathic or being present. They're just the natural.
Yeah.
But what you suggested was actually this is an inherent capacity of all human beings. It just needs to be nurtured, cultivated.
Nurtured. I think nurture is it's a more organic way, yeah. Uh-huh. Nurturing and more organic way of putting it. Cultivation is a bit of force behind it, or training. Yeah, it's like how we talk about it. Yeah, and the beautiful thing when we get young doctors, when we get, you know, professionals, family carers, most of them have no meditation background. Yes, people have heard about mindfulness. They have some sense, but there's this urge, there's something deeper I can do. And so to give them a space, again, we're talking about space, but literally time and the environment where they can explore, how do I understand my own mortality? How is it actually what enables me to show up for another person? What is my intention? So to really then practice mindful awareness is one aspect of presence, authentic presence, being mindful, being aware. Then also the intention, the compassion aspect. And the third is, we may call it wisdom. And wisdom is in terms of intuition, knowledge, but also skill sets. The more I'm actually connected with myself, the easier it is to rely on the skills I've been taught, and then, oh, this is useful, or this is needed, actually, it's more clear. The responses are better or clearer.
You just gave us three very specific.
Yes, so they're the elements of authentic, So the elements, tease them apart, the elements or components of authentic presence. So the first one is mindful awareness. So being mindful of all my own emotional responses and reaction to situations and judgments, so self-awareness, and then learning to regulate my responses and almost my feelings. And and basic mindfulness training, because as you said earlier, we are so distracted and bombarded continuously. So mindfulness is actually then the antidote to that distraction. So I can stay focused, but we also need awareness to have always the bigger picture. So mindful awareness is one. The second one is compassionate intention, to stay connected to my intention to be of service, to be of benefit, because it gets buried so easily. We get sidetracked. It's hard to keep, also when we are tired, when we are overloaded, overwhelmed, and also then the system is too demanding. We're supposed to do really extraordinary work and we are not supported. So just to really connect with that compassionate intention and motivation, with that good heart, this basic good heart, and see it in others. And the third element, my aspect, is wisdom, inner wisdom. So wisdom in terms of our professional knowledge, but also as human beings and on a spiritual level of as this intuition. And really, there's a truth. We all actually know when the truth is spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And at end of life, when somebody's dying, we can see it. And that brings in then the embodiment to how we are. Authentic presence is for me a way of being. Simply, yeah.
Right. So you have awareness.
Yes.
You have mm-hmm. intention.
Mm-hmm.
That you live in a space of wisdom, and the final, and then you added a final one,
the embodiment, because embodiment. You know that, because without it we would, yeah, it needs to be integrated, right? We need to embody it, so it needs to be within us and available, because presence for me is also is a profound level of responsiveness,
mm.
or compassionate responsiveness to mm-hmm. a situation when there's a need.
So I'm particularly intrigued by this concept of wisdom. In fact, the Healers
yes.
Council is exploring a wisdom that can inform mm-hmm. and inspire our work as healers. I'm going to put a pin on that, but I just briefly want to just go
yes.
back to this languaging of presence, because I know that it gets confusing. It's confusing for me, because mm-hmm. this word presence is being thrown around a lot. And I would have you comment on what I think one way of understanding it, that so we can understand what presence we're talking about, right? You know, there's right now, it seems like the way we use presence most of all is what you might call executive presence, right? So there's Amy Cuddy's work, and she's been on TED Talks and has books, which I've read, you know, but it's like, how can I actually be perceived by others as having power?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, that's the CEO. We basically people learn tricks, right? And that's how you use your arms and you go big and mm-hmm. right. And so they have those training programs. I have no doubt that there's a lot more training programs in executive presence than there are in authentic presence. And they probably charge a lot of money. So we have to be clear that we're not talking about that. And then there's personal presence, which is kind of like charisma, right? And this is, oh, you know, and this is Tony Robbins, and mm-hmm. People talk about Bill Clinton, for example. A guy walks into the room and you just like, whoa, you know, he says, and there's training programs and personal presence. But we're not talking about this. We're talking about, how about the word boundless as well, right? It's like authentic, boundless, coming from the heart. So I just want to make that point, because I think folks mm-hmm. can get confused. Oh, do you mean that if I do this, I'll become a good executive CEO?
I think the testing point is really at the bedside, and the bedside is here metaphor for interactions with others who are suffering, who are unwell, who are struggling.
But what I'm also hearing is different from authentic presence. Authentic presence actually is, it actually, when you experience authentic presence, it enlivens you and you actually feel better.
Absolutely, because you're finally your full self. I'm my full self. So I can bring all of it, all of myself to the interaction, to how I am. And it doesn't mean I'm perfect. It doesn't mean I have to have all the answers. But I'm completely accepting of myself. And also there's a lot of self-compassion and self-forgiveness in it. And at the same time also knowing, oh, I'm boundless, you know, this capacity to be that spacious, vast, open, limitless potential we all have. So I have the relative and the absolute and they're married, you know?
Yeah.
And it's okay. I can be completely human. And one of my teachers said, you know, enlightenment is not about, you know, this miraculous thing. It's actually becoming better. You truly become a human being. So that humility.
A happy human being.
A happy human being.
Deep happiness.
Deep happiness. That's deep, a beautiful way.
Yeah. Deep, sustainable
Very,
happiness.
And so, without reason. And I can be in any circumstances. And I don't need anything. I don't need to have my presence validated. That's another aspect. Yeah.
Interesting. So in Tenzin Wanjiao Rinpoche, who has talked about spaciousness, and that he talks about pain bodies. We have a pain body. And it's so when we talk about authentic or boundless presence, it's enlivening. It's actually, it's free of pain, at least some aspects of suffering, right? But the other kinds of presence that we talked about, you know, that physical presence, yeah, you can stand with your arms high and make big and talk loud and stuff, but it's actually, people experience a lot of, it's not sustainable, it's not deep. And this would be a kind of a physical pain body.
And then it's like patches, you know, it's like these are just mannerisms, you know, I can learn this behavior, but it won't help me in a crisis situation, honestly, because I haven't integrated. It's not true. It's not true. And when it's an honest people I sat with, dying people, they can maybe in a very ordinary way can sniff you out. They know as soon as you walk through the door, you've experienced that. As you walk through the door, they actually know, is she with me? Can she endure this? Is she reliable? They know. And so there's no place to hide.
Yeah.
And I can make myself big.
Well, we can try to hide, right? We can try and hide.
Oh, exactly. I can try to hide, you know, and put on my coat. And this is also like, you know, having the door handle in the back and say, and then be out. But this is where I have to that's where this showing up really comes in. I'm here and I can meet you where you are. And that's,
So we can try to hide in our intellectual body. We can try to hide in our identity as a white coat. Or we could try to hide in habits, routines. So we just, we have a routine for examining a patient who's dying. And so that's just being absent. Ultimately, those become pain bodies because they become more and more constricting and cut us off from the real energy, the wontong is that real energy that's in the room available.
They're not connected to who we are, true essence. And that divorce is painful. And the further we move away and caring for other people and beings in general, this is where we actually can be in touch, become in touch. What I've learned being at the bedside, honestly, the most profound lesson about love was, I feel like, always received from my patients.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not even patient, from another human being who faced their end of life. And that there is love if you open that up, and it's not this intimate love or relationship center. It's that's as human beings experiencing this crazy world, you know, of trying to figure things out.
But of course, it's easy for us to talk about this. Yeah. I mean, if you're in Dzogchen Bera and you're overlooking the spacious ocean and sky, but modern healers, of course, are being asked to do something really very challenging, which is to live in all of these bodies, right? They have to be intellectual. They have to make sure they don't miss any lab reports or something that could have been treated. And there's lawyers always looking to catch them. And they have all these regulations. Their identity body is saying, you know, you have to behave in a certain way. And if you get a complaint or whatever, right? So they're always worried they're going to break the regulation. They didn't fill out the right form or something else like that. And of course, more and more modern healers are being told you have to have a routine. You have to have habits. You have to have standard ways of doing things. In the early days, people used to carry around guitars, right, on rounds. And I mean, it was wonderful. And suddenly people would break out in song and, you know, in the patient's room. But of course, now, fast forward, we're a specialty. Oh, no. Not carrying a guitar on rounds. You're a medical specialty, right? So I think it's just really important to acknowledge how challenging it is to. But I think if we can just know which body we're inhabiting, what kind of presence we're in, right? Yeah. Okay, so sometimes I need to be in my intellect.
Yes, and I'm not talking critical of clinical competence. I love that. And we all need that.
Yeah.
And skill set. It's just how we are with that. And it's a skillful means, you know. And absolutely, absolutely. We are in danger of losing the humanness in it all. And that's what I fear. And that's also beautiful here in Ireland to watch that, living in a small country where often I feel like everybody knows everyone. And so I could, you know, I live in a rural island. Of course, in my village here, everybody knows me, but I go to Dublin. I bet there is somebody who knows me. So it's like you always have this human connection, and that's quite remarkable. Oh,
so you have a community.
Yeah, you have a sense of a really profound community. So that's also that work needs community and to be a human being. And maybe, yeah, some of I was just reflecting that in the last training we had a few young doctors and they were just starting out their career. And yeah, I had the same question. I hope you make it, you know, because they were extraordinary kind people, really kind. Right. The person you really would like to have tell you the quote bad news, right. You know. Yeah. If she tells me that, I could hear it. I know you're there for me.
Right.
And I said, so I was really wondering, and then a friend of mine, another colleague, reminded me, you know, if you just have a few everywhere, imagine, no, they see thousands of people at the end of their career. They made it just a ripple effect. So not to give up hope.
And you bring up something important there, which is this idea that presence, you know, this shouldn't be just about dying.
I mean,
the work that you're doing can be translated into our communities. What I hear you saying is that when you live in a small village, you are being seen by everybody, for better or worse, but you're being seen. There's this sense of I am not invisible, but unfortunately, more and more, it seems like in our modern world, we have become invisible to one another. And when we are no longer visible to one another, I actually have a story that I speak about in my teachings that we haven't got time for it. But when a nursing matron said to me, young doctor, you need to understand that for my young nurses, these patients are invisible. So we are now experiencing a life in which we are becoming invisible to each other. And when we are no longer experiencing or being present to others, we can do awful things. The head of the Physicians for Human Rights gave a talk many years ago that I attended, and he said something that resonated. He said, the vast majority of human rights violations are committed without the perpetrator even being aware of what they are doing, right? Because we have become blinded to each other. And your work is so important. And maybe this is the healing that we can bring back to our communities, that yes, you can be present, but this is a skill set. And we have to know, as I hear you talk, it's almost like, okay, I need to literally consciously be observing myself and say, okay, now, what level of presence am I in right now? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to be in level one presence and be in your intellectual presence, if that's what the situation demands. But it's not appropriate when somebody is dying, and it's not appropriate to be in that intellectual. Maybe I need to then switch into authentic presence. But if we can do that consciously, right?
Yeah, to drop in. Yeah, because we cannot always, you know. There are days that are harder. I have something happening at home or something, you know, that's hard, or, you know, I'm not unwell, or I don't know. So there are things just to recognize, today I try my best.
Yeah.
You know? I just try my best and I'm here. But often once you acknowledge that, that limitation dissolves, isn't it? Sometimes you go into a flow, but it's like, yes, to learn that, to really, and I love to call it dropping into. Mm-hmm. So it's a dropping into and resting in it, you know, and sometimes it's a bit more on the surface and sometimes it's deeper, but also this authentic presence is not only about us as the care provider or caregiver. it's also about the other person. So we create it together. It's a dynamic field, you know, because sometimes the other person inspires me because what he, she truthfully tells me a really heartbreaking story or something that resonates with me. And, oh, yeah, I really hear you. So it opens my heart. So allowing the other person to open my heart.
And I also think, my experience is being with people who are dying is that actually, I would say actually the majority of people, at least in America, at that phase of life and moving into dying, actually maybe don't want to get into authentic presence. But it's the ideal that this person suddenly that they've had this experience. But some people want to hold on to the executive presence or the intellectual presence, and I have to be aware of that, right?
Yeah, and that's complete. And that's actually also. With that idea, it's not, I think the danger is talking about it like we again create another concept, you know, of right and wrong. It's so easy as humans, we love to do that. It's, oh, this is the box, I drop into authentic presence now, I have it covered, and I'm fine and I'm safe,
you know? And the patient, damn it, is going to be
and the patient, you know, exactly. And so it's not that, it's so that's where humility and humor comes in. Mm-hmm. It's also mm-hmm. it's create space where there is none. That's the definition of humor.
Absolutely. So we are coming towards the end of because I'm going to be respectful of your time, but I'm going to ask you to stay a few more minutes. Gee whiz, you open up the box about wisdom, and that's a big one, because what is wisdom anyway? But I don't want to hold you too much with this, but I'm just going to, just a little bit, if you could, you went on a 3-year retreat. Dr. Yonten, who's on the podcast, who wrote the book Compassion as a Remedy, talked about how within his training, there was an expectation that the students go on retreat, the medical students. Now, they just did a 3-month retreat, not 3 years. But he said, he unfortunately couldn't do the 3 months because they were too busy. But gee, this idea of having a retreat, and do you think that this is something that's necessary to becoming wiser? Can people just do the work and just be self-reflective and have a teacher? Mm-hmm. Did every medical student have to go away for 3 years and make it a long training?
I think that's a bit impractical, no, isn't it? And it's not for everybody. It was my choice to do that. Uh-huh. I think, that would be the wrong message, you know. If you really want to serve others and relieve suffering, this is what you have to do. I hope not people walk away, listeners don't walk away with that message. It was my own choosing, because I felt like I needed to deepen my own understanding. And what I really learned in the 3-year retreat, to get to know my own mind and really learn to fully accept myself and be compassionate. And as one of the main intentions and what I want to prepare for my own dying, because I noticed and recognized, am I just really kidding myself? Because sometimes sitting at the bedside, I could feel, I feel like I'm bulletproof. It's not happening to me. And it can be, I realized at the time, was very subtle or not so subtle. This is something I have to address. And it seems like an ongoing journey. So that was one of my intentions and during the 3-year retreat. Because when you sit in your room alone, you have to face yourself. Yeah, you really have to face yourself and what you're attached to. And gain confidence. I think confidence is another good thing to talk about. The confidence that the practice works, that these contemplative tools and principles and methods really work. They're deeply therapeutic, they're being therapy. To utterly rely on spiritual tools, you know, and have confidence they work. So I can wholeheartedly say they do work. Meditation absolutely works to work with your mind. It's not a necessarily pleasant experience. Because many people say, it's so wonderful, I wish I could go to, and it's peaceful and loving, and how nice. And it's actually, a retreat in itself is complete opposite. you take everything with you and you recognize everything is in your mind. There's nobody else to play. Mm-hmm. So you have to really just be quite humorous and be spacious with yourself. And also trust, this deeper trust to there is something that's bigger and can hold it and you can drop into it. And yes, it's okay. You're okay. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's a wonderful perspective. Finishing off, actually, before I ask you this question, I just want to, we talked a lot about contemplation. I just wanted to alert people that there is an organization that started last year called the International Society for Contemplative Research, ISCR.org. And it's just, I'm really optimistic that this can become a container for us to try to bring together these different worlds, whether it's the intellect, whether it's the identities, professional identities, whether it's the first person practices. So ISCR, I just wanted to mention that because they have a conference coming up in Italy in the middle of this year. So we need an excuse to go to Italy, to Tuscany, I think it is, and that's ISCR. We have a tradition here where we are asking our healers, what advice would they give to a young person? This could be your next door neighbor's. She calls you up and says, hey, my daughter's thinking of going into a healthcare profession. And we know that you're involved with that. And can she come over and have a cup of tea? And how can you help her? And so what advice would you give to that young person, and succinctly? And this is not about what professional school they should go to or whatever. Yeah. But what heart advice would you naturally want to share with a young person? Could be even yourself sitting across the table having a cup of tea or an island of Guinness, perhaps. what would that be?
The reassurance you're good enough. Yeah, you're really good enough. Relax. Be at ease. I think that deeper relaxation and ease,
Okay, so recognize your own inherent goodness, that you are enough.
Yeah, that's the message behind that,
So everything that they're going to hear is that they're not enough, that they didn't get enough.
There's always something you don't know, and then you have to cramp everything into your poor mind,
Yeah, thank you. That's a wonderful piece of advice. I can get back to drinking the Guinness, right? All right. I do miss the Irish pubs. We have the oldest pub in America in my little village in 1776, but it's not the same as an Irish pub. And I do hope that the rugby team does as well this year as it did last year, and the Six Nations coming up. So I want to thank you, Kirsten, so much for this wonderful conversation. It's been really, truly wonderful, and I hope that we'll get back together again on these conversations. Perhaps I came across this quotation that I really love, and I think it sums up a lot of what we've been talking about. And this is Thich Nhat Hanh, who passed away recently. He said, when you love someone, the best thing you can give them is your presence. How can you really love them if you are not there? I think that sums it up, right? Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation. And-